Well, good morning and a welcome to each one of you this morning. What a beautiful morning the Lord has blessed us with this morning. And I got up, I could see that there was maybe someone was getting rain. It didn't really look like it was going to be us, but we've been getting it in buckets out there this morning. So we thank God for that. And I'd also like to take this time to thank you as a church for helping us the last few weeks since Max was born. We've felt your support just in people stopping by with small gifts and meals. You've been a very generous church to us, and we thank you for that. We have some good cooks in our church, I can tell you that. And generous as well. I think all of the meals we had leftovers, and I tell you what, leftovers get a bad rap because I sure was happy for them. I've been eating good the last couple weeks. I thank you. I noticed Kevin Leona made it back. So welcome back, Leona. It's good to have you with us again this morning. So for our message this morning, you know, as Jesus walked on the earth, he frequently spoke in parables and lessons, and one of which can be found in Luke 13:6-9. And I'm going to read that this morning. It's one of the shorter parables he gave while he was here. And if you're turning to that, that is in Luke 13, just three verses there, 6-9. And he spake this parable: a certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came and sought fruit thereon, and found none. Then said he unto the dresser of his vineyard, behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and find none. Cut it down, why cumbereth it the ground? And he answered and said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig about it and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well, if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. And the lesson I'd like to pull from this parable this morning, there's two lessons here. The one is that the gardener, Jesus, is very patient. But the other lesson, this one I'd like to expand on this morning, is that this tree was expected to bear fruit by the owner of the vineyard. Just as our Father in heaven expects us to bear fruit as well. And we do have an advocate in Jesus who's advocating for patience. But at some point, it's interesting in this parable, the gardener does not ask that it be overlooked. He just asks for patience. There's going to be a time when this tree needs to bear fruit. And so as I was thinking about the fruits of the Spirit, fruits of the Bible, or the fruits of the Christian life, I thought about the verse in Galatians 5:22-23, and that's what I'm going to focus my message on this morning, the fruits of the Spirit as are listed there. And I'm just going to read those two verses, and that is, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. And sometimes we get fruits confused with gifts of the Spirit. And part of that is because oftentimes we like to see the gifts of the Spirit in action. And those are something that we strive for, and I think we should strive for as Christians. Whether it be the gift of prophecy or of teaching or of healing or any of the other spiritual gifts in ourselves and in others. And our churches would have a difficult time functioning without that. But we should never use the gifts of the Spirit as a measuring stick as to how spiritual we are or how spiritual someone else is. The fruits are what Jesus is looking for. And sometimes, I don't know if this is a great illustration, but this is how I see it. The gifts are like the branches and leaves on the tree. If a tree looks big and beautiful, the potential there is to grow lots of fruit, and normally a healthy tree will. But a tree that's maybe doesn't look as nice, maybe doesn't have as thick branches, but is producing lots of fruit, that's what Jesus wants to see, lots of fruit. Typically, a little scrawny tree doesn't bear fruit because it's not healthy. But let us be if we allow ourselves to have our gifts utilized, typically it can produce even more fruit. And so we should strive to improve our gifts as well. But like I said, what I want to focus on this morning is the fruit. What do those branches, what is being produced there? And Paul does sort of illustrate that in 1 Corinthians 13, 1-3. He says, "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And although I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. Though I bestow my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing." So it's sobering to know that we can be the most impressive Christians in America, but it doesn't mean anything if we're not producing fruits. And those efforts can be in vain if we don't have those fruits. And love is what he underlines here, and that's the first one of the fruits he gives in Galatians. So I'm going to just look at that a little bit more in detail. And I want to look at each one of these fruits in detail. And as I was studying, I did feel like, well, I feel like I took too big of a bite off. So I may not be able to get as deep into each one as I'd like to, but we're going to try to hit each one of them this morning. But Jesus was asking Matthew, what is the greatest commandment? And his answer was to love your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. But he went a step further than that. And he said, and the second is like unto it, love thy neighbor as thyself. On these hang all the law and the prophets. So what is love? And what does it look like? What does it feel like? You know, love is a feeling and an emotion. But it's not just that. Love is also a choice. It's a commitment and it's even a sacrificial action. You know, love is the glue that holds our society, our church, and our families together. Can you imagine a world without it, where every relationship would be about giving something to get something of equal value in return, more of a transactional-based relationship where I will only do this if I get something? Love doesn't operate that way. Love goes beyond that and above that. You know, and I like how Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians 13, where he says, love bears all things, it believes all things, it hopes all things, and it endures all things, and it never fails. And if we get a hold of that verse, I think we can maybe get a little bit better hold of what love actually is. You know, this past week, there were two very famous people got engaged. Some of you may have seen that. I don't really follow celebrity news. I didn't even realize it was a big deal until it was all over just the regular news that I read. But I thought back on when I became engaged and what my understanding of how I knew Stephanie back then and what my understanding of love was, and how it has, I don't know, it's changed, but it's just my idea is different than it was back then. And so, you know, as I was thinking about that, I'm very excited for them. And I thought if I had any advice to give them, what I would tell them, and this was Travis and Taylor, two famous people. What I would tell them is that don't expect your emotions to sustain your marriage, because there's going to be a time where emotions will not be enough to carry your relationship. And you know, you can stop loving, but that's a choice that you make. It's not something that just happens. And I've heard this in some marriages that have not worked out. It says, well, you know, I just didn't have love anymore. And it's said in a way that, you know, it just kind of went away, but it doesn't just go away. It is actually a choice that we make. And as Christians, we need to make the choice to love daily. To our families, to our church people, to our church brothers and sisters, and to the world around us. You know, if we're filled with the Spirit, that should be a natural response. It's not because we always love what we're feeling, but because the Spirit that's within us compels us to love. And what about joy? You know, joy is more than just happiness or good feelings. It's rooted in something much deeper than the circumstances around us. And joy has an element of surrender to it, because like love, it's a choice that we make. We can choose to accept the things outside of our control and find reasons to rejoice. And one of my favorite verses about joy is found in Psalms 30, verse 5. And I'm just going to read that here this morning. It's, "For his anger endureth but for a moment. In his favor is life. Weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes in the morning." And I find that such a powerful verse because we will meet sorrows in this world. We will have reasons that are outside of our control that we find very, very difficult to accept. And weeping will endure. But joy will shine through that. When the time of weeping is past, when the time of sorrow is past, we will find joy on the other side. If we are a spirit-filled Christian, we don't dwell on that month after month after month and allow it to drag us down. And some people have felt like, well, if I have to have joy, can I really experience sorrow? And my words for that, my thoughts on that is that, yes, you will. It's okay to be sad sometimes when bad things happen, when you lose a loved one or something like that. But if we have the spirit within us, joy will return. And it allows us to rise above the circumstances that normally drag us down in discouragement. It doesn't ignore the things that upset us, but rather it finds us to help the positives in them. Peace. What about peace? You know, peace in the Bible is not just the absence of conflict. It's a state of wholeness and of harmony with the world around us and the freedom from fear. And to have peace, we must learn to trust. Do we trust the Father to carry us through the difficult times? If not, we will have a hard time coming to peace with the things that happen around us. One of my favorite illustrations of peace was from my youngest daughter. When she was a little bit younger, she was afraid of thunderstorms. And when a thunderclap would hit, she would drop whatever she was doing and with a look of terror in her eyes come running for me and just jump into my arms. And it was amazing to me how fast, as soon as she was in my arms, I could just feel all the tension leaving her body. She just relaxed. And as I thought about that, I remember thinking about that as I was holding her, and I was like, can I do this with the Father when I am afraid? Can I run and just jump into his arms, and then when I'm there, just let it go. Just forget all the troubles that I had before that. You know, the average adult, where I'm at here. Yeah. One of the most effective things that we can do to improve our health is actually to worry less. In America, 30% of American adults are considered to suffer from some kind of anxiety disorder. 30% is a lot of people. It's believed to be a significant factor in about half of the heart problems that we have in our country, in our health system. And one study puts the economic cost of anxiety at $42 billion a year. So that's a significant amount of money and resources and even health issues that we have because we have a hard time coming to peace. And I love Jesus' words in John 14 where he says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled. Neither let it be afraid." You know, the world has many solutions for anxiety. It's from amusements to alcohol to counselors and medication. But Jesus says, "My peace is different, and I'm just giving it to you." Is that something that radiates from our lives? Can we accept that peace that Jesus is offering to us? Another fruit is the fruit of long-suffering, and you know, I think this may be the most difficult one for many of us. I feel like it probably is for me, at least. The word long-suffering, a synonym for long-suffering is patience, but long-suffering sort of goes beyond patience. It extends to those legitimate grievances that you have against another person. But can we extend that hand of forgiveness and not give in to the anger, even though that person may not have changed or repented? And that's the idea I get from long-suffering. But, you know, as interesting as I was studying these fruits, I kept coming back to the idea that each one of these is a reflection of our Father, of God. It says in 2 Peter 3:9, it says, "The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness, but is longsuffering towards us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance." You know, at some point or other, whether we did it knowingly or otherwise, we've taken advantage of God's long-suffering towards us. And as a Spirit-filled Christian, we are expected and even have an obligation to be long-suffering towards the world around us. And, you know, that looks different for each one of us. For some of us, it may be a customer that's been very difficult to work with. Maybe he hasn't been willing to pay as was agreed upon, or maybe he's just really being difficult. But for others, it may be a lot more personal than that. Some of us have very close family and friends that have wronged us and have at times done so without remorse. But it's good to remember the verse there in 2 Peter where God has been long-suffering towards us, and he's not been willing that any of us should perish. And so why should we see individuals any differently than he does? The next one is gentleness. And what is gentleness? Because I was looking at this one, and some translations translate this as kindness. And so maybe that's a word we're a little bit more familiar with, but it's being kind and considerate of others, and even when we don't deserve it. And again, that's a theme that I've gotten from these fruits, is that as I was studying this for this message, it's like the fruits are not dependent on whether the people that we interact with deserve it. It's something that we're required to do and we're compelled to do because of the Spirit that we have within us. It's just a result of that Spirit. You know, gentleness, it is an action. It's not weakness or fear of confrontation, but it's rather a strength under control. It's not letting someone walk all over you, but it's choosing kindness even when provoked. It's showing kindness when you have nothing to gain. You know, subconsciously, we tend to see every relationship as a transactional one. It's sort of like when we go to the grocery store and we fill up our cart with groceries. The expectation is that when we have our week's worth of groceries, we pay the grocer the money that it's worth, and that's the length of our relationship. And it's easy for us as humans to see everybody in sort of that kind of light. So I'm dealing with you because, well, I need this from you, and you're willing to give it because you need that from me, and there's always this push and pull and give and take. And I think some of that just comes, we're just programmed that way. But I heard recently that you can learn a lot about a person by seeing how they treat someone who can give nothing back in return. And it's something I've thought of a lot since then. You know, how do we see the homeless person? Do we treat him differently than a customer that's just given us a bunch of money? Do we, the people we interact with that we think, well, this person, yeah, he's just here to take. Do we still show kindness to that person, to that individual? You know, goodness is kind of along the same lines, but goodness sort of reflects more of a moral excellence. It's maybe a little bit beyond just the surface level things, but it's not just avoiding evil, but it's actively doing what is right and beneficial to others. But I didn't want to spend a lot of time on that one. I wanted to look at faith as well. And, you know, to illustrate faith, and many of you have probably heard this story before. It's the story of Charles Blondin. He was a tightrope walker, and in the late 1850s, he became the first person to walk across the Niagara Gorge on a tightrope. And his tightrope was about 1,100 feet long. And at the highest was over 160 feet above the water, and this is right at the Niagara Falls. And so he did, over the next couple of years, he did a number of stunts that, on that tightrope. One of the things he did was he crossed it blindfolded. Another one is he carried a cook stove and cooked himself an omelet as he was going across. He also crossed it on stilts, which I cannot imagine how you would do that. I mean, I don't even want to walk down this aisle on stilts, much less on a tightrope, you know, for certain death. But his most famous stunt was pushing a wheelbarrow across. And of course, this is back in the 1850s. People didn't have television, so when there's a big event like this, there's huge crowds would come out to watch. So he gets back with his wheelbarrow. He's like, "You think I could push this thing across with somebody sitting in it?" And the crowd went wild. They're like, "Absolutely, yes, you could." He said, "Well, I need a volunteer." And history tells us he did not get a volunteer. So the crowd believed he could, but they didn't actually believe that he could when it came down to it. But then I read later on, he convinced a man to ride on his back as he walked across the tightrope with somebody on his back. And those two stories really illustrate the difference of faith. One man had faith, but I guess the rest of the other crowd didn't, even though they like to believe they did. You know, Hebrews 11 tells us that without faith it is impossible to please God. Faith can be summed up as believing when you can't see, trusting when you don't have all the answers, and obeying even when it is hard, and resting in who God is, not just in what he does. You know, earlier this week, there was a horrific shooting at a Catholic school in Minnesota. Some of you have maybe been aware of that. It took place during the Mass in their church. It's a Catholic church, so they Mass, it's kind of, if you've never been there, there's prayer and it's kind of a devotional involved. And it was disappointing to me to see some public figures took the opportunity to openly mock the power of prayer, with the governor of California going as far as to say that obviously prayer does not work because these children were literally praying when the shooting happened. And you know, for someone that is not a Christian, I can see how it's easy to come to that conclusion, because it doesn't make sense if you're not a believer, if you don't have that faith within your spirit. And, you know, it was interesting. He was very roundly, there was a lot of people that were very upset with that comment. But what I found was interesting is a lot of Christian people said the same thing with their actions in that, well, that's why we have to be armed. That's why we have to get security at all these church and schools. And I thought, well, is that any different than what the governor said? But, you know, events like that, they can shake us. But it is not in our place to decide for God what is right and what is wrong. We can only trust in knowing that he cares for us. Faith is not about believing only when we get the result we want. It's believing unconditionally and knowing the one with power, the one with the power to change everything, does hear us and has our best in mind. The next one is meekness. And the word meekness is often misunderstood. You know, many think that meekness is the same as weakness or passivity or just kind of being a pushover. Jesus said in Matthew, he said, "I am meek and lowly." And then he also said on the Sermon on the Mount, he said, "The meek shall inherit the earth." So what is meek? I found it interesting as I was studying for this that the Greek, so Galatians was written in Greek, and the word that Paul used for meekness was the same word that the Greeks would use to describe a war horse, a horse that they would take into battle with them. You know, a war horse was powerful and fast and strong, but it was under control. And that was the descriptor that Paul used here. You know, it is not a pushover. It's quite different. It's about being humble and teachable and responding to offense with grace, to yielding your rights, and then, of course, trusting God rather than demanding control. And the last one here is temperance. Temperance or self-control, it's the ability to master your desires, emotions, and behaviors. It's an inner strength to rule over your inner passions. Proverbs 25:28 says, "He that hath no rule over his spirit is like a city that is broken down without walls." You know, even Proverbs recognize that somebody that has no self-control is very limited to the potential they can have. The stability that comes with a city that has walls around it, he puts that up against a city that's been broken down, and it's like there is no security there with something like that. You know, to maintain a consistent testimony, we as Christians must exercise self-control. The temperance movement, as it became known in the United States, is about avoiding alcohol, but the temperance he's speaking about here goes far beyond that. It includes resisting excess, whether that's something like food or pleasure, and not responding in a fit of rage, and even thinking before we speak. Now, how easy is something like that to do? Sometimes I find those to be a lot more difficult. Just say what I have on my mind instead of thinking about, well, is this really a good idea? All these things, and this is another one of the fruits, that if we are filled with the Spirit, it should be a reflection of that. You know, as Christians, we are obligated to bear fruit. It's not something that's optional, but it's rather required. And if we're filled with the Spirit, these should become natural for us. So may God be with us this week as we strive to faithfully bear fruit for Him. So would you kneel for prayer, those of you that could?